Gentlemen, paper two.
So paper two, please discuss. So paper two, to TUSCI discuss employee benefit plans with guaranteed return on contributions or notional contributions. And paper two is a cover note that explains what each paper discusses and also summarize the previous discussion. So we will start with paper 2A. In paper 2A, we have analyzed whether the agreed scope should include benefit promises with vesting conditions, demographic risks, and salary risks. For vesting conditions, IS 19 does not distinguish between vested benefits and unvested benefits. So therefore, we propose benefit promises with vesting conditions should be within the agreed scope to be consistent with IS 19. And for demographic risks, demographic risks arise from various assumptions featured in the benefit promise. And if we exclude benefit promise with demographic risk, that will result in scoping out a plan.
Luca.
Even if the plan
have joined the conference.
Sorry, let me start again. So demographic risk, if we exclude benefit promises with demographic risk, that will result in scoping out a plan if the plan contains only one demographic risk. So that results in scoping out lots of plans. So we recommend the benefit promises with demographic risk should be within the agreed scope. And for salary risk, we think benefit promises with salary risk should be outside the agreed scope because including plans with salary risks would result in an unnecessary change for those plans, and we don't think any issues for such plans at this moment. And the final question for the committee is do you agree the agreed scope should delete the reference to future events other than salary risk? So do you agree with the staff recommendation for question 1 to 4?
Comments? Luca, any comments?
In general, I agree with the conclusion of the staff. I think that the approach adopted is correct. I have only some doubts regarding the demographic risk, but I think that at the end, the analysis and the conclusion of the staff can be sustained and accepted. So for me, there are no specific comments on this point. I agree.
John?
I mean, I'm troubled by the rationale that the outcome of whether we include a lot of plans or a small number of plans should be the rationale for whether we include these risks or exclude these risks. It doesn't seem to me to be a basis for determination of scope. I agree with the staff position on the vesting conditions. I think that's consistent with IS 19 and makes sense. I don't see the logic for including within the scope plans with demographic risks, or neither do I see a logic for excluding those with salary risks, because I don't think any logic is actually provided in the paper.
Andrew?
Yeah, my comments are not dissimilar. I think the objective of defining the scope is to be as tightly focused on those plans where the mismatch between the discounting and the asset-based return that determines the benefit is the most distinct and clear. I think I certainly do agree that we should include benefits with vesting conditions because that's linked to service. I think when I look at the list of demographic risks, the one that jumps out at me is mortality. I think that is a very substantial determinant of the benefit, which is not asset linked. So the mismatch issue is less clear cut, less one to one in that situation. So I wonder whether that is broadening the scope too far. I think some of the other examples of demographic risk, I would accept the comment that these will be very common features of many plans, and to exclude those would exclude too many plans, so I'm not sure we can treat all demographic risks the same.
Scott and Tony?
I think I had some of the same views, certainly happy to include plans with dusting conditions. On demographic risks, trying to think through it, I tried to go back to what our original scoping was of this, and we started out with plans that would be defined contribution plans, except that there is a guarantee of some sort on the asset return. And looking at these demographic risks, I'm not sure that defined contribution plans would typically include these risks.
But what if the guarantee included some of these risks? So you had a DC plan, but you were guaranteed some minimum return that was subject to a demographic risk. Would you not want them included in?
I'm not sure, but if you tell me that the demographic risk is solely tied to the return, I feel a lot better, or solely tied to the guarantee, pardon me, I feel a lot better about including it. But as it is, I was feeling wary. Almost feel like we should start out by not including them, develop a model, and then when we expose it, ask whether we should bring in demographic risks and give some examples.
Tony?
I'm broadly comfortable with where the staff got to. I think it makes sense to include vesting conditions, and my sense is that the objective of broadening out the scope is to make sure that we address as many of the plans for which the accounting at the moment sort of fails the common sense test because of the interaction of a guaranteed return with the model in IAS 19. So it seems I agree that the determinant of the scope shouldn't be the number of plans that are affected. It should be to make sure that we capture the plans for which the accounting at the moment doesn't make sense. So I agree with everybody who's spoken that vesting conditions should be in. And it seems to me the example of a demographic risk that would play in is a situation where the guaranteed return is turned into an annuity and is therefore subject to mortality risk. I think that's the easiest one. It's relatively common. And for that reason, I think it makes perfect sense to include demographic risks in the scope, because I say that's a relatively common type of arrangement.
When we talked about this paper yesterday, I observed to the staff that this may be the 27th paper I've read on scope revolving around this, between the old D9 stuff and then the IASB's project, and it's always kind of a Goldilocks situation. Reinhardt?
My comments are similar to the comments made by the others, in that I also agree with including vesting conditions in the scope. On demographic risks, like some of the others have comments, some of the others have raised, it probably makes sense to take a closer look at the different types of demographic risks before deciding whether to include all types of demographic risks or only certain kinds of demographic risks. And then with respect to salary risks, I agree with excluding those because I don't see much of a difference between average salary plans and current salary plans, so I agree with that.
Charlotte?
Yeah, I think I agree with most things that Jeff said. I agree with the answer on vesting conditions and salary risks. I wasn't sure on demographic risk where the line was. I can see the point on the guarantee, which is the example given, but I could also see where demographic risks are included in other ways and actually create more than just a guaranteed return. So I think we needed to assess how they were included in the plan rather than just saying it's the nature of the risk that matters.
Martin?
I believe most of the pension promises include, in a way, demographic risks. So therefore, I believe it is at least necessary to start trying to find a solution for it. I mean, if we at a later point in time then decide that for specific reasons it would make sense to take specific demographic risks out, then we should decide this at a later point in time. But I personally, I would not cut it's already at this point in time.
How long?
I think it makes sense to remove the exclusion of demographic risk and the vesting conditions. But for the salary risk, I think that they may need to be much more clear on what is being excluded. Otherwise, we will be back to arguing whether something is current salary plan for an average salary plan, or whether or not an average salary plan includes salary risk.
I think on this point it was just, I guess, a question of whether you want to include plans with future salary risk within the scope, and it was our understanding that those plans are the traditional defined benefit type final salary plans, which can be included. Other types of plans, such as average salary and career average salary and current salary, would be included within the scope of this. However, when we talk about, you know, the fixed versus variable later on, we would still do the defined benefit accounting for those types of plans.
Sandy?
I guess I agree with the removal of future at the beginning, because I always struggle with that, because everything, that included everything, right? And I agree with the vesting conditions, but I really struggled on, you know, I agree with what John said at the beginning, that I don't see how salary risk is so inherently different than other demographic risks that it's being excluded. I didn't see that there was logic in there other than it produces, it was defined in the accounting that we maybe didn't like. I guess I struggled with what inherently was so different about that particular risk that made it separable and different. I don't know.
For salary risk, essentially the employer is taking on the risk of future salary increases in the promise. And you could say it's similar to the other types of risks as well, but I guess that I thought the objective of this project was to focus on the plans with variable types of asset risk. Now, we've talked about this before, how it's quite difficult to distinguish between different types of risk in order to set the scope, and it's probably the reason why we keep coming back on to discuss scope, because it's quite difficult to separate these types of risks out. However, if we want to do a narrow scope amendment, we need to make a distinction at some point. And that distinction might necessarily be arbitrary if we want to get something done on this. And I think that we just need to, we're asking the committee to see where we should focus the scope of this project in order to address the more troublesome plans. And plans with salary risk haven't been identified as troublesome, and that was seen in the comment letters to D9 and the 2008 discussion paper. It comes back to the balance between the set of promises we want to be affecting with this project and how far you want to the scope to extend.
Florence?
I was in agreement with the staff proposal and with respect to salary risks. You said, Manuel, at the moment it's not the plans that are causing problems. So I don't want to create problems where there aren't any problems and there is no diversity. So this is why I agree with your working assumptions. Maybe later on, when we see where we end up, we can compare where we end up and what the response we get to would apply if we were to include those plans with salary risks, to see whether there are very much differences. But at the moment, trying to progress on that difficult topic, I think that the scope is the right one.
Okay, I've heard probably 8 different proposals. They boil down into, let's think a lot harder about this now. Let's go with this and then revisit it later. Let's go with it all the way to exposure and find out. let me propose this. The scope of a limited scope project is frequently arbitrary. And it's frequently driven by the Goldilocks effect. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. And so it is frequently focused on particular products. Is there sufficient support for the staff moving ahead on the basis that they have in 2A with the promise that they will return to you before we finish and say, okay, now that you've seen everything that we've done, do you want to change the scope? Is that an appropriate or acceptable way for the committee? I see a lot of head nodding yes. I don't see any head nods no. So, permission to proceed with the promise that you'll come back, which you probably would have done anyway. So. Okay, 2B then?
Yes. Paper 2B for those of you in radio land.
So, paper 2B discusses distinction between fixed and variable components for plants within the grid scope. In D9, the variable component was based on whether the return on contributions was specified by a reference to the market rate on a particular asset or group of assets. The comment letter to D9 found the distinction not clear. In particular, it was not clear how benefits with both the variable return and a fixed return would be accounted for. We think it is difficult to split such composite plants into a variable and fixed component. Instead, we think the interpretation committee should define the variable component positively and treat other components as a residual so that two categories are mutually exclusive. We present three alternatives of how to define the variable component in paragraph 26. We do not recommend the second alternative, which defines the variable component by reference to one or more types of classes of assets, because the outcomes would depend on arbitrary set of rules. We have analyzed the effect of the two remaining alternatives, as in the Appendix A, and we recommend the first alternative, which defines the variable component as a return based on the actual return on plan assets, because we think it would strike the best balance between improving the accounting for troublesome promises and at the same time limiting the effect of the change of the plan, a change of this block. So, do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Martin?
I was a little surprised that we cut off the discussion whether the fixed component would be defined, particularly number 24, just with the argument that it's the default that the case of the plan benefits the plan. So, I'm not sure whether it would have been easier
to come up with a definition where we have the fixed component positively defined. And the paper has no further conclusion on this, whether this would be easier. And I see already with regard to the, well, number 26 and what we have written there, that it might be challenging to end up with a, well, positively definition from variable.
I think, just on that comment, Martin, I think C is essentially that option, which says any variability at all would be classified as a variable, which by definition means that the other side would be anything that's purely fixed. I think that the concern that we've probably had with defining the fixed positively is perhaps unintended consequences, because if we didn't get that definition right, then things perhaps would fall within the variable component that we didn't want to fall in there. So we wanted to keep the fixed one as the residual. So if there is anything that we haven't thought about, it would still get accounted for under the defined benefit type of accounting.
I wasn't sure to understand the proposal. When you say promises of return on contribution based on the return on actual plan assets held, do you mean that you're restricting an identification of variable components only in case of plans that are financed? I was unclear then, what do you do when you have notional contribution?
I think that's well, the, yeah.
Can you have variable components? Can't you have variable components? I was not sure to understand.
Essentially, yes. I think for option A, it is very narrow. It limits the variable component to basically those plans that are defined contribution, but for some guarantee. And the variable component is equal to basically the plan assets. I think once we start talking about notional contributions, then I think that's where we start getting into alternative C. I think alternative C, however, probably goes a bit too far and captures too many promises. We would have liked to find somewhere in between, which was alternative B, but we haven't been able to identify something, a definition of the types of variability that we would be comfortable with, and we would be able to define in a robust manner to ensure consistency and applicability, which is why we kind of ended up back at A. But it all comes down to the balance you want to strike between how far you want to go and how many plans will be affected.
Do we have any idea whether by going through that scope, that distinction, we are capturing most of the plans in existence? Do we know? Do we have any idea whether we are capturing 50% of the plans, 80% of the plans that are causing problems, or?
We haven't done that kind of survey. We'll probably need a lot more time to do that type of survey to gather that information. From the comment letters that we received on D9,
yeah,
and the discussion paper, there are quite a lot of plans that define their return based on an asset-based reference. However, that's independent of how they're funded, and they would not be included in option A. However, they would be included in option C, but option C would probably include other ones, which you may not want to include.
Okay. Tony?
I think I share Lawrence's concern. I sort of think back to the objective of what we're trying to do here, which is to address the accounting for a range of plans where applying IAS 19 creates an answer that sort of fails the common sense test. And I think if we're doing that, we have to accept that we are creating an exception, and there won't necessarily be a principle behind the exception. We're just saying that for this group of plans, IAS 19 fails the common sense test. And I agree that option C is too broad. I'm troubled that I think, as you just said, Manuel, that option A is going to exclude quite a large number of plans for which the accounting is troublesome. It's also going to mean that two plans with identical promises could be accounted for differently, depending on whether the promise is based on the actual assets held or a notional portfolio of assets. And it seems to me to be an odd outcome that we end up with different accounting for two identical promises. And I think I would prefer, as a way forward, even if it's arbitrary, to define something by reference to the asset base on which the contributions are, on which the promise is based, whether it's notional or whatever. I'm not quite sure what that would be. I'd be happy to think about that some more. But I'm just concerned that what we have at the moment is going to exclude quite a wide range of the plans for which the accounting at the moment fails the common sense test.
So that's kind of C prime.
C prime or B prime either. It's just a way of it's going to be a little bit arbitrary. But I think I'd kind of prefer to have a rule behind the exception than not fix the problem we're trying to fix.
Okay. I understand the concern that Roland and Tony raised, but reading through the papers the staff prepared, I also have a concern that moving towards it, trying to resolve the cover of more plans, that may end up complicating the issue and end up not reach the consensus. So I think for now I'm kind of leaning towards the staff recommendation just to limit the actual plan assets and see how it goes, because I can understand if the staff concerns that if we go through the route arbitrary or notional contribution to try to define the measurement methodology of that asset, that ends up can fall apart this project. So I just limit the scope of at the moment of this and going through other measurement methodology and then come back here.
Joanna and then John.
I think I'm very much on the same page as Kaz in terms of for the reasons that the staff have set out and coming back to, and maybe it's actually saying, what is it we are trying to address? Because you say it's defined contribution except where there is a guarantee or there is a promise, which I see as, and partly why I didn't talk on the scope bit was because to me it is arbitrary, but that is really narrow. Now, Tony is talking about all those that IS19 doesn't work for, and I actually think that that is something different. And reading through your logic that you've put through here, to me, absolutely it is that defined contribution bit, it is the actual asset, and although Tony and Laurence are saying yes, it is excluding some, and they are identical promises, I'm not sure they are actually identical promises if they're not on on the actual plan asset, and then it's hard to say, but I honestly, and I'm saying I'm thinking because I'm not an expert in this area at all and don't see them that often, but I am much more inclined to go with the staff way, certainly at the moment, for the simplicity and the narrowness and actually addressing the actual issue we're trying to address. As Wayne says, this has failed so many times before. Let's see if we can deal with it at this level.
Scott, you haven't been in before on this one, so I'm going to let you jump the queue.
All right. Well, in the spirit of trying to come up with something new, I will fail. I also think that A is too narrow. I think if we don't pick up the notional contributions, we're not picking up enough of a plan. My sense is that a lot of these plans are unfunded or are funded only with cash that isn't necessarily invested in the same assets that the returns are calculated on, because the funding company or the funding entity, sponsor of the plan, what have you, doesn't feel like they should have to invest the assets based on whatever promise they made. And indeed, in every other pension plan, they don't have to. It's not a defined contribution plan, and so they don't think that the promise or the beneficiary should decide what the assets are invested in. And so they don't fund these plans. And if we're not picking those up, I think we're missing a whole lot. So I think that A is going to be too narrow. I do get the concern with B, the number of assets or asset classes or groups of assets that one could come up with is endless. You could base the return on the appreciation or depreciation in a model of car, and you could do anything, and those get awfully tough awfully quick. I wonder if there's a way to make use of some other definition that's already in IFRS to define the types of assets that we would be comfortable calling variable if the return were based on those assets. Maybe something in the fair value hierarchy, level one or level two assets work, level three don't. I don't know. I was kind of trying to poke around. I didn't come up with anything that was clearly satisfactory in that regard, and I'm leery of creating something new, but I think if we go with A, we'll be way too narrow.
John?
And I had sort of reluctantly agreed with the staff recommendation because I thought of the difficulties in trying to define a broader group of assets that we might include. I mean, we keep coming back to this issue about the problem plans. We're trying to scope this so that we cover the problem plans in IAS 19. I'm not sure I actually really understand exactly the problem plans that we're talking about. I mean, we have said initially these are plans that would be DC, but for the guarantee on actual or notional contributions. But the debate seems to be roaming across a whole lot of plans that are much broader, potentially in scope than that. So it seems to me that we I'm not sure that we've got a common view as to what actual plans we're trying to get inside the scope of this bucket. And until we do that, it seems to me we're going to find it difficult to reach agreement on these scoping questions. I do think this would be very narrow. I do think A would be very narrow. I mean, I'm happy to support and go forward with it, but I think it probably won't meet the needs of those who think this is going to solve a broader array of problem plans with IAS 19, in IAS 19.
Reinhardt?
I agree with the comments you made, Wayne, that any limited scope project ultimately will have to have some arbitrary boundaries as to what's in and what's out. But what does concern me about alternative A is that, as others have mentioned, that plans with identical promises would not be accounted for consistently, primarily because they have notional contributions. And that seems to me to be more of a rules-based distinction as opposed to principle. And so, I, on the other hand, I do think, agree with the staff that alternative C is too broad because it scopes in too many things, including things like wages or inflation. But as I say, I'm troubled with this particular alternative A being too narrow in focus.
Tony?
Yeah, I'd like to come back on something that Joanna said, and I don't want to be misinterpreted as saying that I was hoping this could address all of the plans which IAS 19 doesn't work, because that would be a very broad range of plans.
Some might suggest all of them.
My focus was very much on the ones where there is some sort of guaranteed return. And to pick up maybe something that John said as well, the simple problem with that is if you project it out using the expected return and discount it back using the yield on high quality corporate bonds, you build in a liability where one might not exist. Because maybe the company is holding the assets, and it's that group of plans that I think we're trying to address the concern around, and that's why I shared Scott's concern and Reinhardt's concern that A excludes quite a large number of the plans for which this is a specific issue, and. While I don't have the answer, I just don't think we're solving the problem if we go ahead with something that is that narrowly scoped.
My sense of the comments that I've heard is that the general view is that A is too limited, that we need something bigger. Certainly, that captures plans that have a notional balance. And I can understand. I think the simplest reason why you wouldn't make a contribution is if you don't get a tax deduction for it. And in that case, you set up the plan and you run it on a notional basis, and then you make the contributions when you do get a tax deduction. So I think we need to cycle back on this one. Take another look. Whether it's B prime or C minus, I'm not sure.
I guess if we do that, we have tried on multiple occasions to find some kind of other basis to make that distinction, and we always come up against the same problems about trying to I guess people would be comfortable with things like wage indexes and CPI, etc., being accounted for under the existing IS 19 methodology. However, some other types of returns, people might feel uncomfortable with them. And also, whether the plan is funded or unfunded, based on perhaps by similar types of assets to what is promised, but perhaps some other things. So there's a lot of different dimensions to this, and it could get quite complex quite quickly. Just wondering, is there any particular direction that the Interpretations Committee wants to go down this path?
Well, before asking Gary to come in on this one, I think what I heard the committee saying was an index based on the value or return of assets. So an index based on CPI is not an index based on the value or return on assets.
So you can create an asset with that return?
No. An asset being a financial instrument defined in IAS 39, IFRS 9, that is available in the marketplace.
You can create that kind of asset.
No,
you can go to an insurance company and create that kind of return. That's always been we thought about whether it's an investable asset, but any asset could be investable. You can go and create a derivative or something. And
I guess my point being, and I don't want to argue it here, if you have to go and create it, it's not one that exists in the marketplace today.
If you actually do create it and fund the plan with it,
then you were already going to include that in A.
So
yeah, I think we'd probably be happy with that. In the absence of the return tied to actual plan assets, I think what Wayne is describing is a good starting point. And if you're not going to tie it to actual assets, then it's a variable component that gets out of the defined benefit measurement if it is by reference to real assets that exist in the marketplace, make it financial assets to make it a little easier, and maybe we want to narrow that as well to something that is available in sufficient size to cover the promise. I'm not sure how far we want to go. But it seems like that's a starting point. The fact that you could create any asset doesn't do it for me. Now, if you actually do create it and fund the plan with it, okay, I'll grant you that.
Yeah. I think that I wasn't offering it as a final solution, but it does seem to me the way we had it. Gary, board member privilege.
Perhaps more of a question than a comment is, and if Wayne or if you or Michael can't give the answer in 1 minute or less, let's just take it offline. But thinking, cash balance type plans, these other notional funded type plans are huge on the global scale. And I know, I don't know about this board, certainly the FASB wrestled with cash balance plan accounting and kind of kept kicking the can down the road and stuff. How is this at the Interpretations Committee and not at the full board? I mean, this seems too big of a question. With the reaction in there, I'm going to deduce that that's been discussed. But if you can't give me the answer in 30 seconds, let's take it offline and break. I don't want to hold it.
Actually, I was going to raise that, a very similar question, to the committee after paper C.
Okay.
So let me
take
you offline for, not forever, just for a little while. Charlotte, and then let's wrap this one up.
I think I wanted to come out and say I was probably more in the narrow camp because I could see the problem that the staff had said, because even reading the example, I looked and said paragraph 29, well, I can invest in S&P futures, so I'd be in A, so I'd be okay. I don't think it's a matter of creating assets. A lot of these assets exist, and so you're just saying if it references to those assets, it's okay, which then the scope arises. And to Tony's point, I think there is a difference on a promise made on a funded plan compared to a notional, because the actual liability of the entity is different. You have the scope to have a bigger liability because you have that gap risk of what you invest in compared to what your plan says. So it doesn't feel as horrible to me that there's a different result, because they feel different in nature.
How is it different? Just to understand your comment. Granted, I have a bigger liability because I haven't funded the plan. But if I fund the plan and take that funding and invest in S&P futures, 100% of it, drop the whole thing, and I guess I'd want to invest in S&P linked bonds or something like that, but whatever. How is that a different promise from saying, I'm not going to fund the plan today, but I am going to promise you the notional contribution plus the return on an S&P linked bond? How are the two different?
It's a different promise. It's a different risk.
Yeah, credit risk as well.
It's the entity's credit risk.
Right.
It's also a market risk that you're taking the risk that you'll be able to generate that return not by investing in it. An entity that's investing in the S&P doesn't have any more market risk because it's locked that in. It's not got any sort of optionality or derivative risk at all. It's flat. It doesn't care what happens to the S&P in the meantime.
And I'd say one other thing.
The plan is funded. So I'd take that into account together with the credit risk point and say that 19 tells you it shouldn't be different for those reasons.
Okay. What I'm hearing is that this one needs to go back to the workshop. And Manuel is grimacing at that because he thinks he's been back in the workshop, but I think we need to take another look at it.
Okay.
2C?
Yeah. So 2C discusses recognition and measurement for plans within that risk scope. We split the discussion between non-variable components and the variable components. For the non-variable component, we recommend the defined benefit accounting in IAS 19 should be applied to the non-variable component because the current accounting for fixed return promises has not been identified problematic. So the first question to the committee is, do you agree with the staff recommendation? Maybe I should stop here for the first question.
Comments? A couple of heads nodding yes.
Okay.
That's
on. So for the variable component, we split the issue into several aspects. First one is measurement of fair value. We recommend measuring the liability of the variable component at the fair value of the underlying reference asset, mainly for the same reason that Ifrit stated in developing D9. And for unvested benefits at the reporting date, we recommend that if a benefit is unvested at the reporting date, the measurement of the plan liability should be determined by the extent to which they're expected to vest in the future. For the benefits that include a margin, we recommend the general principle identified for the measurement of the variable component should be applied to benefits that include a margin. For credit risk, we recommend the liability of the plan should be measured at the fair value of the underlying assets instead of the fair value of the entity's liability because considering the balance between the cost and the benefit. For attribution of benefits to periods of service, we recommend the variable component of a benefit promise should be attributed to periods of service in line with the benefit formula. Because departing from the benefit formula would complicate the accounting for both the contributions and promise return components. So the question two is in page 10. So do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Going once. Scott?
Trying to walk through each of these. Yes, in general, if we have a fixed component, certainly using the underlying, or the fair value of the, a purely variable component, using the underlying reference assets makes sense to me. as we got further and added in all of these, you know, addressing the specific issues, I wasn't entirely sure how the staff was proposing to address them. For example, the margin. So you get the return on the plan assets plus 2%. And the fair value of the asset that we would be talking about there is the actual asset plus a 2% return discounted back?
This is the problem with the composite type of benefits, and if in the previous paper we went down option C, where the composite type, these compounded benefits would end up in the variable component, then what we were saying in paper 2C is that you would need to come up with some kind of or invent a hypothetical asset that will replicate those returns and then fair value that asset.
So a bond with higher risk and therefore higher return than the one that's actually in the plan?
Yes, basically. So you'd have to invent an asset.
Then I don't like that. Then we're coming up with the hypothetical fair value of an asset that does not exist and using it to value a liability, right?
This is the problem of once we go down the notional route and we start to include promises that are based on some derivative of an asset value, however, do not include the total return of that value or include some adjustment to that return, we need to come up with a way to measure them if we're going to include them in the scope of the variable component.
One more reason to stick with view A if you want to go back and add that to... to the previous paper. The only way I could figure out on these margin ones was to start out with the fair value of the actual assets and then take the margin, turn that into an ongoing, set of cash flows, and then discount that back to a number which would get added to the fair value of the actual assets.
That was suggested in D9. The comments came back on D9 and said that can't be done because what happens is you're actually compounding the fixed return on previous variable returns as well.
Absolutely you are.
So it's not possible to make that, or it would be incredibly complex to do that calculation.
We would clearly have to simplify it beyond so that people aren't required to project out the variable returns on which the fixed returns would be compounded. But that seems a lot easier than coming up with a hypothetical bond that doesn't exist or a hypothetical equity instrument that would be expected to earn 2% more than the actual equity instruments. I don't even know how to do that, right? We're actually invested in HSBC stock, and we promise a return equal to the return on HSBC stock plus 2%. What is the equity security that would match HSBC's return except be 2% more? Because whatever it is, I want to invest in that, by the way. I generally think HSBC is a pretty good investment, but one that earns 2% more is better. I don't know how to do that. So that was one where I wasn't sure I knew what the paper was suggesting, and now that I do know, I don't like it. I agree that we should not consider credit risk. That sounds good. I'm not sure about allocating the variable component in line with the benefit formula, because benefit formulas could be all out of whack. Hopefully they won't be, but I'm not sure I agree with that one. On that one, I could move forward and wait for comments to see if it's going to cause a real problem. So I guess of your five questions in question 2C, I don't like the answer to. The other four are okay with me. Of course, C goes away if we go back to the narrow definition of the variable component that you proposed before. See, you should have put these in a different order. I might have had a different answer.
Luca, I don't want to forget that you're here.
No, I'm here. In general, I agree with the idea of the staff. I think that with reference to this element linked with margin, we should do some additional analysis considering the size of the scope that we will define. I share some comments made by Scott regarding the fact that if you are looking to something that is not in your portfolio or worse, that is something that is only hypothetical, there could be some elements of complexity that are also even higher considering the elements of the margin. For the other elements, I agree to do not include the element of the credit risk inside the calculation, and I agree that in any case the reference should be a fair value as the great line to do the evaluation and considering the possibility and the probability that the plan will be vested or not. My only concern is linked with the margin, but it's linked with the previous paper. I think that we have to look at the previous one and verify which will be the real scope in order to take a decision regarding this element of margin.
Okay. Andrew?
In terms of the five questions under question two, I agree with A through C, although I do accept there are some challenges around fair value in hypothetical assets. So my question, my doubt, was around the allocation to periods of service based on the benefit formula. And we have agreed that benefits subject to vesting conditions will be within the scope, and also that unvested benefits would be a measurement issue rather than a recognition issue. Is this discussion for some schemes potentially frustrating those two previous decisions?
There is an interaction there. I think the problem with IAS 19 is, of course, the defined contributions get attributed differently to defined benefits.
Yeah.
And we're trying to reconcile the two here, which doesn't really work.
Yeah.
If we're trying to find a way to attribute these types of benefits and then fair value the allocated amount, I think that's going to be quite complex.
Well, we're facing a sort of third way here. We need to draw on defined contribution technology. Is that the best way forward? This needs to draw a distinction between an unvested benefit and an unvested contribution promise. I'm not sure if that's the most meaningful distinction to be drawn.
I think that the vesting conditions can come in sort of different forms. I think where you have contribution formulas which attribute different percentages to different periods of service, I think that's where the issue comes up.
Yeah.
Under defined contribution type of plans, that would not be sort of attributed evenly or straight lined or anything.
Sure.
And that's the kind of approach that we're trying to take with these types of plans in order to match the DC type plans as opposed to the DB type of attribution.
Tony?
Yeah, I guess I was broadly comfortable with where the staff had got to here. I understand the complexity with valuing a notional asset, if you like. I wonder, like Luca does, the extent to which that problem is going to exist in practice. And I wonder if it's worth a little bit of thinking about that before deciding that it's a gating problem for the issue. But I was broadly comfortable with where the staff had got to. I think the only, if I may add to E, an additional complexity, is the accounting for employee contributions. When you're thinking about attribution, if you think back to some of our other discussions.
Okay. But I think the amendment would solve that. Definitely.
But that, I'd be comfortable with going ahead on this basis.
Subject to a couple of reservations. I think that's the view you've gotten. Okay, now, Gary's question, which was going to be my question. And I'm not going to ask y'all to take a position today. But it's always been my view that in any project that takes more than one meeting, we ought to have a point at which we stop and ask ourselves, is this trip really necessary? Should we continue to invest in this? Of course, the sunk cost is already sunk, so we probably ought to think about how much it takes to finish and all of those kinds of things. I think Michael and I know that Michael and I will bring you a paper at the next meeting to ask you about whether or not we should continue to work on this project, which has the dubious honor of having frustrated the Emerging Issues Task Force, the FASB, the IASB, previous populations of the Interpretations Committee. And, you know, I would dearly love for us to fix the problem or some part of it, but we're covering a lot of the same problems that they had, and we're starting to send the staff away and say, well, we know you've thought about this, but you need to think about it some more. And that's also a point at which we ought to take pause. So, for now, I'm not asking for any views unless, as Scott does, you have a burning desire to express one. But if you all have any ideas between now and January, if you would share them with Michael and me, I would appreciate that. And we will bring you a paper that essentially says, do we want to stop? Scott?
As you said, this issue has frustrated everybody. You know, this is one of the reasons I think that we tried to start with a narrow scope, and we keep, you know, thinking we ought to add more things because the more things are like the other things, then we can't do it. Rather than drop the project because we know this is a big problem, I would prefer to narrow the scope to a set that we are comfortable with. For example, if all we addressed was plans with guaranteed returns or with returns tied to actual assets, if that was all that we addressed, that would be better than addressing nothing.
By actual assets, you mean actual assets in which the plan is invested?
That's correct. Yeah, okay. I mean, I would like to do more than that. I think we should. But if that's all we can do to come up with an answer that, you know, we feel comfortable with and is workable, then we ought to do that. Now, if we literally can't even do that, then we ought to drop it because we got nowhere to go. But if we can at least do that, then I would not want to drop the project entirely because even that will be useful. You know, perhaps it still leaves, I don't know, 75% of the problem plans still as problems, but okay, solving 25% of a problem is better than solving none of it.
As a reminder, this didn't get on our agenda just because Michael and I have a burning desire. We were asked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall if it was a confidential submission or...
I think it's called something.
So I can't attribute it today. But we were asked, and I think we were asked specifically about the notional contribution list. That was a part of the original submission. Laurence?
In order to make an informed decision at the next meeting, once I will read your paper, I would also like to get feedback in those jurisdictions that are particularly effective, and which include, obviously, U.S. cash balance plans, Japan, Netherlands, Switzerland, and Germany. If we don't want to read out throughout the whole world, I think that in focusing and trying to get feedback from the national standard setters in our trip, this would be very helpful. And I come back to my question is, in going into that direction, are we addressing 80% of the problems or are we addressing only 20% of the problems?
Point taken. Okay. I think we've done all the damage we can do. Pardon?
At the agenda paper 2C just has a notes a couple of things about the higher of options. The committee has already taken a decision on this issue back in November 2012, I think, almost a year ago. And it said that where the a promise or a benefit promises a return, the higher of a variable type of thing and a fixed promise, that the intrinsic value of that, the higher of the benefit as it would be measured under this approach on the variable method, and the higher of and the benefit as would be measured, the fixed benefit the guarantee would be measured under the existing IS 19 methodology, the higher of those two would be taken as the liability. In September 1, when at the Interpretations Committee update at the ISB, one board member raised objections about that particular approach and whether that would be representing or basically representing the fair value of that guarantee or the economics of that guarantee as considering that some of these guarantees could be in place for 30 plus years and the time value of that guarantee could be quite substantial. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And there was another comment about the higher of two variable components. And this is simply the case if the promise is the higher of, say, two different returns that fall within the variable bucket under the approach suggested in 2C, then that type of option would be fair valued and then the time value of that option would be taken into account. Any comments or questions?
All right.
Well, I was not a strong believer in such place when we took that decision a long time ago. And since then, I've seen some cases or illustrations of implementing the intrinsic value approach, and indeed does not reflect the fact that you are in presence of an option. And so I find sometimes the outcome a little bit weird. But that's the question. So how would you value the fact that it is an option in these circumstances? So I was interested to see whether, since we last discussed the issue with my colleagues, whether you have evolved on the subject as well, or why you still believe. This is again about those arbitrages you have to make. You know that the answer is not perfect, but in order to simplify, this is where we go.
Charlotte, then Scott, then John.
Yeah, I think I agree with what Lauren says. I would be supportive of using the fair value, but I wasn't sure of the reason the intrinsic value was chosen, whether it was chosen as a practical expedient, that it was actually just the easiest thing to calculate, which goes, I understand it, but I would imagine you should offer people the option of doing the fair value. But I didn't want it to be the background to the decision.
See, the background to the decision is simply because IS-19 at the moment doesn't take into account the time value of these types of options when you're doing the IS-19 methodology. When you're projecting forward the ultimate cost, you don't necessarily take into account these the option value of different outcomes. It's quite deterministic in that way.
Scott?
I'm okay using the intrinsic value here. I think for better or for worse, we, with few exceptions, typically do intrinsic value for employee benefits. We try to come up with what we're actually going to pay.
you could do fair value for if you got a higher of based on a fixed return and some assets. Well, we can certainly come up with the fair value of that option. It's just an exchangeable bond kind of methodology, I think. So it's doable, but this is already complicated enough. I'm fine sticking with the intrinsic value.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I have a preference for fair value for reflecting the substance, the option. But I think it would depend. I could be swayed to say that intrinsic is better if there's a real complexity and a real difficulty of interfacing a fair value with the IAS 19 methodology. But my preference would be fair value.
Tony?
I think that taking these at fair value, it adds a layer of complexity, but it also, as Manuel said, it's kind of inconsistent with where IAS 19 goes. It's not a fair value model. I understand that there's optionality in there. I understand that there's time value in there. But I just think that's not really consistent with where IAS 19 goes, and it's something that I guess I'd probably rather save up for the day that IAS 19 comes back on the table in its entirety, probably when I've retired.
I was going to say, you and I are close enough for retirement age. Yeah. That's not going to be an issue. Anybody else?